Welcome to the Mentoris Project in Mentorship, Books, and More. In this project, we interview authors for a new series of books on the lives of the men and women who mentored Western civilization. I'm your guest host, Dr. Peg Lamphere. For more information, visit mentorisproject.org. Today's guest is Roseanne Welsh, author of America's Forgotten Founding Father, a novel based on the life of Filippo Mazzei, an Italian immigrant who befriended Benjamin Franklin in London and then moved next door to Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Together, the men wrote many pamphlets supporting the American Revolution. In one of those, we find Filippo was the first person in the colonies to coin the phrase, "All men were created equal," which Jefferson liked so much, as we all know, that he used it in his Declaration of Independence. Welcome, Roseanne.
Hey, Peg. Good to talk to you.
So, tell me, why does Mazzei matter to us today?
I think he matters for a lot of reasons, partially because we're having a long conversation about immigrants and what they contributed to the United States, but also because the Italian-American community sometimes gets a little saddened by the fact that we are focusing on lots of groups who do need our attention, but people tend to forget that the Italians went through the same kind of discrimination when they first came here. Little by little, they were considered odd and ethnic and strange, long before anybody thought spaghetti and meatballs was an average American meal. Mm-hmm. So I think recognizing the contributions of a man who was an immigrant from Italy at that time period and how much he gave to this country will help other people realize that immigrants are people that we need to focus on.
Let's hope it works, right? What were the burning questions and issues of Mazzei's day? Issues that engulfed him, you think?
Well, he's really an interesting guy because he came here to be a farmer and to start wine country in Virginia. That was his goal. And so it was all about agriculture and what could be made of this area that would be financially feasible. So he came to do that, but of course he got wrapped up in all the revolutionary stuff. So that became, the politics became the overarching goal of his life, to see this little place become its own country. And of course, as we know, at that time, about a third of the Americans were pro the revolution, and a third of them were against it, and that middle third that can't ever make up their mind had to be convinced. So he spent most of his time with Jefferson and with other friends like Madison and Monroe, who were the younger generation of revolutionaries, writing pamphlets, explaining things, in the same way we credit Thomas Paine in all the history textbooks in America.
That's interesting. So it sounds like he had a lot of important relationships with men that, whose names we know. What other important relationships did he have?
Well, he was acquainted with the wives of all these men. And of course, in his own life, he had a couple of women that he knew from Italy. His own mother was a very important person to him. But there weren't a lot of women of accomplishment in those days that he connected with. He did know Abigail Adams, and he wrote with her. But outside of that, it really wasn't as many as I wish I could report.
Probably one of those things that gets lost in history, don't you suppose?
That's the kind of correspondence that doesn't often get saved. That's exactly right. Whereas there are books and books of his letters to Thomas Jefferson, but all the other stuff doesn't exist.
Yeah, all things Jefferson have been saved.
Exactly.
Who do you think his competitors or antagonists were?
That's really interesting because, of course, again, there were Tories in the United States who didn't believe in what he was doing, and they were able to use his differences a little bit against him if they wanted to shoot down what he had to say. He was bringing a European sensibility or mentality to the colonies, and so there were some people who thought that because he had lived in London for so long, he came from Italy, he moved to Turkey as a young doctor, actually, and then he moved to London to become a businessman and to run actually a wine import business. So he spent a lot of time in London. So there were people in the colonies who thought, oh, you like England. How can we trust you? And so there were some, there was some conversation about how he might be a spy or someone that we can't have on our side. So there were, even among the revolutionaries, people who didn't trust him, possibly because of his ethnicity as well.
That's interesting. Do you think him being Catholic played into that?
Yes, that was definitely the weird religion to be a part of, and he was very Catholic, so I'm sure that there were two strikes against him when it came to that. And also, he was speaking actually a third or fourth language at that point, and he knew he didn't speak it well enough, so that when they got around to calling various men to come to the Continental Congress, he was invited originally by some of his friends, but he decided he couldn't follow the verbal debates in the way that he would need to, because he preferred to write his ideas down and to translate. So he stayed home. And I think that's part of the reason we don't know his name, because if he'd been a member of the Continental Congress and actually signed the Declaration, at least his name would be included in that list mm-hmm. of signers that we've seen repeatedly. So I think it was an issue that there wasn't a whole big solution for. There wasn't Berlitz back in the day, so you learn the best you could.
Well, I suppose like everybody learns their second or third language as best they can, picking it up here and there.
True. It always fascinates me when I have friends, academics from other countries who come to conferences in the States and they speak English for the whole weekend, and I have to keep remembering they're doing this entirely as the second language. I know, I can't do that.
That's really impressive, yeah. Yeah. What did you know about him, or what did you think about him before you began researching this project?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I didn't know anything about him, which is what struck me when I was offered the opportunity. I thought, how can there be a founding father that I am a religious watcher of 1776, every 4th of July. I've read the play it was based on. I've read biographies of Jefferson and Madison. I'd been to Monticello at Ashland Highland, but I've been to all those places, and I thought I knew that. I love John Adams. I've been to his home. To think there was this Italian-American there that nobody referenced. It really, really bugged me. So I knew nothing about him going into it and came to find happily there was a sister, a nun from Connecticut, who had collected his writings and a bunch of information about him and published it, but they were in little rare books you had to order, you know, from interlibrary loan from 10 states away in order to see this. So she had the material, but she hadn't the ability to get it distributed widely.
So you're a historian, and I know historians love research. What was your favorite thing that you found out while you're researching?
Oh, that's probably the fact that he traveled across the ocean so many times. I think we have this opinion that people tend to stay near the place they're born, or at least in the country, or in our case, the state they're born. So to find out that he went from Italy, like I said, to Turkey, all on caravan. Then he went to London, then he came here, and then during the war, his Virginia friends paid him to go back to Europe and solicit money and weapons and support. So he's traveling back and forth and back and forth, like a person going on a cruise, kind of. And I was really shocked at the fact that so many people could travel like that. And you always hear about people getting sick on ships, or it was a very dangerous...
It's like a really big journey that lasts forever and everyone dies.
Exactly. And yet he did it back and forth and back and forth. So that the ability to travel was something I hadn't considered was so possible back in the day.
That's interesting.
And then in terms of him personally, I love the idea that he came from a close-knit little family, although sadly his mom had a favorite and it wasn't him. And that was sad to figure out, but also very interesting because it allowed me to
humanize
him.
Maybe it's why he left, though.
It could be why he left the country. He knew he had to make it on his own because his older brother took all the family money when his parents died. And so I found him to be a sympathetic guy, but also somebody who never let the series of bad things that happened to him never defined him or stopped him from moving forward. And I think that was really impressive.
What in your own background gives you a connection to Mazet?
Well, I happen to be Italian-American. I wish I was first generation, but my grandparents had come from Sicily, so Sicilian-American, if that makes any sense. And so my mother was the first person born in the States, and my family was very tight-knit Italian family, all the cliches that you see outside of the part where everyone's in the mafia. the big family party.
It is a cliche. Yeah.
It is a big cliche. So, I mean, I've always been very interested in famous Italians and that sort of thing. And you don't get exposed to them in the textbooks. There's a great...
I really don't.
John Leguizamo is doing a piece on Netflix right now called Latin History for Morons. And he goes through all the stuff that doesn't show up in textbooks about Latin Americans and what they contributed to the country. So it was weird. It was allowed me the chance to do the sort of the same kind of thing, not in a comedic way. So I was happy about the fact that I came from that kind of family. I've traveled to Italy several times, so I understand and really love the country. And I'm a historian, so obviously I wanted to know more about the American Revolution than I had studied in the past.
Yeah, we don't think about that as a period of Italian immigration because the big waves come much, much later, don't they?
Exactly. Although because he came to start the farm and then he brought some Italian-American men with him. Well, I shouldn't say American. They were Italian men with him to start that and to be the managers of his plantation and all of that. He essentially begins the Italian migration to Virginia in this early 1770s period. And what's really cool about him is Because he needed men with specialized training to do wine cultivation, he used these men, not slaves.
Oh.
And I looked and looked and looked to see if he ever used slaves for anything else, and I found no proof of that. And I did find some letters and some arguments he had against slavery. So it was really cool to think, here was a guy who was kind of going, look, we can do it this way, follow me, follow me. And he couldn't get his buddy Jefferson to, like, play in his ballpark.
That's so really interesting, because that is a troubling thing about the Virginia Founding Fathers.
It always is. And the thing is, using essentially indentured servants, which it's not like everyone was all nice to them either. No. But at the end of your 7-year contract, you got land. And so there is proof that pieces of Mazet's plantation were then given to the men who had come with him and done this work for him for that period of time. So he followed the rules of that all the way through.
That's pretty interesting. So this is a novel. It's a fictionalized account of Mazet's life. What's your favorite fictional account in the book? Your favorite thing that you kind of had to make up?
There were all the family conversations. There were some conversations when he was a child that he mentioned in later life, and things like he remembered that when he was 8, his grandfather's little store had been robbed. So that's all I had. But of course, I had to dramatize this moment of being in the store with grandpa, and it was a place I imagined he would have loved, and his grandfather was somebody that he loved because his mother kind of, you know, was focusing on the older brother. So I thought about the lessons I wanted him to represent, and I made sure that the place was robbed, they were safe. And then he thought, oh, we have to go after that person and catch them. And the grandfather was like, no, they probably needed it more than we do. And, you know, we don't have to do that. We have to move forward in our life. And so having his conversations with his grandfather, I think, were the coolest things I got to make up.
That is fun, isn't it? One of the fun things about fiction is imagining people's personal lives.
Yeah, because that's the stuff nobody records enough, right? I mean, we don't, or if they do, that's not what they keep. They keep all their professional papers, and they think their personal papers aren't important.
Private life disappears.
Exactly.
True. Did you find any themes that ran through his life, or any in particular theme or themes that you used to focus your novel?
I did. It, to me, seemed like what he was about was equality and freedom, especially in the non-use of slaves, and the fact that he was trying to prove to his mother, I think, that he was as valuable as the older brother. Mm-hmm. So he tried to gain as much education as possible, which he did. He actually was a doctor, and then he was a businessman, and then he was a politician in many ways. And then he was a little bit of a soldier. He joined the militia in Virginia, too, and did some stuff there with the young dudes, Monroe and Madison, you know, running around to the governor's office, home, and, you know, shouting at night and scaring him and whatnot. So he was very accomplished in many ways, and I thought that was very cool. So I think the belief that you can make something of yourself, and it takes hard work and study, but you can do that. And then this business of equality very much interested me. And I think in the end, he proved he was the equal of all these men around him, even if the history books don't reflect that.
So who were his mentors, and who did he mentor?
Certainly his grandfather in the very beginning, which I think is a very beautiful relationship, and it's very key to Italian families, to any ethnic family, really. Mm-hmm. So his grandfather first, which was great, and then there was a doctor that he met when he was younger and he was studying, who thought that he was smart and said, I have this practice and I'm traveling to Turkey, do you want to come? And that was the beginning of his ability to see the world as a larger place that he could actually function in and not be held back by his brother's sarcasm or attitude. So I think that was the first big step in his life, and he helped that gentleman with the practice for a few years. Then, it's funny, I would say maybe Franklin, except he and Franklin were kind of equals when they met. So I don't know if there was mentoring going on there, or it was just really a nice, solid professional friendship. They met because a Duke of Tuscany wrote a letter to Filippo and said, I'd like to have a Franklin stove. And I understand they sell them in London. Can you buy a couple and ship them back to Italy? And Mazet, being sort of a perfectionist, said, well, I happen to know that Franklin is in town right now. And he wrote a letter of, you know, got a letter of introduction because he wanted to buy the proper one. It turned out all over the city, different people had different stoves for sale with little modifications. And he thought, well, I want to get the right one. So he went to Franklin, they became friends. And then Franklin got mad going store to store going, well, that's not mine. You did this wrong and you changed that. So they eventually found two that were the least modified. And then Franklin readjusted them. And those are the ones they shipped to Italy. So I think that there was more of a professional friendship going on there than a mentorship. And then when he came to the States, well, the colonies as well, Jefferson and he were equals. They both owned land together about the same amount and did the same work. But we do find that with the indentured servants, these are the people that he mentored and he got them started mm-hmm. in their own agricultural success. So yes, I would say that it came from the doctor and his grandfather and then these young men that he helped when he came here.
So did he leave a community of Virginia wine making or grape growing people?
He did. The problem was a few years into his experiment, there was a bad season and they didn't get enough water and the crop was wiped out. And then the war happens and mm-hmm. he actually has to lease his place when he goes back to Europe to solicit funds. He leases the place and it's then leased by actually a British officer. And he lets his horsemen trample all over the place and doesn't care about the land. And that's not very pretty. And meanwhile, Jefferson's up in Pennsylvania, so he can't help. So that kind of ruins everything. So his own strain of wine went away. But over the years, there has been wine cultivation in Virginia. And there is a collection of Mazet wines that are sold by Monticello to this day.
That's pretty wonderful.
It is kind of cool. But, so they remember him. The Monticello, they had a lot of good records. And his wife died while he was in Europe, and she's buried in the Monticello graveyard.
Oh.
Because Jefferson was looking out for her while her husband was gone.
He was away.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very dear.
It's very sweet, and actually, it's funny, because she wasn't a well-loved woman. Oh. Apparently, she caused a lot of trouble, and Mazet kept trying to, like, smooth it over, and he couldn't always. But she had a daughter everybody loved, and that daughter got married, and she and the husband lived on Cole, which is the name of Mazet's plantation. And again, Jefferson sort of acted like a stepfather to them while Mazet was out of town doing other work. So the families were very intertwined.
That's pretty interesting. It makes his missingness from history even more perplexing.
It does, because he does appear in lots of letters with Jefferson. Although, because they lived next to each other, then there are great times when they didn't write to each other. So maybe that's why early historians, and of course they just focused on when he wrote to Adams and when he wrote to the big names. Mm-hmm. And they let those go to the wayside. Which makes me wonder how many other people were intrinsically important to that period whose names have disappeared.
That's really interesting.
It's sad because they contributed. Every one of these people contributed something along the way. And again, all the kids ever read about is Thomas Paine, Common Sense, Thomas Paine. That's it.
Right. It's one of the things that makes the American Revolution not very interesting for young people, I would argue, is the same seven great white men.
True.
Listen, we always end these interviews by asking this question. Roseanne Welch, who is your mentor?
Ooh, that's a lovely question, too. I would always have to start with my mom, who has been an amazing mentor in my life and made sure that I had a college education when she did not. And that was a big deal for her because she was a single mother, so there wasn't a whole lot of money. And there was no, you know, we talk about the concept of having this culture of college in your family. And if your family's done it, it's easy for a child to follow in that path. But mm-hmm. if they haven't, figuring out how to manipulate it and how do you do financial aid and which school do you pick and how do you deal with teachers, you don't know how to do that. And my mother did the best she could to give me as much background and help me read about it and talk to people. So definitely her. And then in the writing world, I mean, there's been a lot of writers I don't know, but whose work I read that really impressed me and made me want to do more. You know, everyone in the screenwriting world loves Nora Ephron, and I did some screenwriting for a while, so she's always a woman that we look up to. And Elaine May, who gets lost also in the history books behind some other men from that period because she was in a comedy partnership with Mike Nichols. And she did as much work as he did, but he tends to show up in more books than she does.
Right.
So I've been discovering a lot of women whose work I knew who other people don't seem to recognize. So that's been a whole other side project of mine. But I do think in the real world, my mom is probably the best definition of a mentor that anyone could ask for.
That's a pretty good answer, Roseanne. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
This has been guest host Dr. Peg Lamphere, sitting in for Dr. Roseanne Welch. The Mentorist Podcast is sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate. Technical direction by Douglas E. Welch and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read these fine historical novels, please visit mentorisproject.org.